We have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. And as usual, plenty to cover. So let's dive in, starting with the Seattle School District.
Yeah, the Seattle School District announced a proposal to save money on busing this week. And their solution, which didn't solicit any public input because they gave the excuse, the school district staff gave the excuse that they didn't have any time to solicit opinion from...
That wasn't what the account that I read was that they thought that the public could take go, you know, jump into Lake
Washington. Yeah.
But maybe they refined it after that.
Yeah, yeah. They must have said, well, gosh, I guess we should just tell them we didn't have enough time. Their idea was to start some schools an hour earlier and some schools an hour later, and then also double the commute times for some students in order to save money on busing. And parents didn't like that, of course, because what if you have a student in one school and type of school and a second student in another type of school, then you're spending 4 hours in the morning trying to get your kids to school before you can even go to work.
And of course, if it's an hour later, that may interfere with your ability to go to work.
Yeah, and if your kids are dismissed from school one a couple hours earlier than the other, then who's going to pick up and take care of that kid? So, you know, it was not popular with parents, and parents raised an uproar. And of course, the school district had to backpedal and say, well, you know, maybe we can come up with another solution. And the school board said, we're not voting for this, et cetera. But it really reflects on the attitude at the Seattle School District that they could propose something so drastic, changing the start times of schools, staggering them in that way, and not expect to have the parents cause an uproar.
Or more to the point, not even consult with anybody before they announce it.
Yeah, not even to say, look, just, you know, send us an email and tell us what you think. You know, it's up on our website or something. They didn't even do that. So, you know, it really shows you what the attitude is at the Seattle School District and what the new superintendent is going to have to deal with.
All right. Moving on, update on the DOJ and SPD negotiations?
Yeah, there were some developments in the negotiation between the Department of Justice and the City of Seattle over reforms at the Seattle Police Department. Now, we talked about Mayor McGinn and Police Chief Diaz releasing their 2020 plan. There was a little update to that this week. McGinn came out and announced the names of 34 cops who would take leadership roles and help initiate some of the plan's elements, of course. And then he turned and said, the very first thing we've got going is the Speaker's Bureau, which really tells you what the 2020 plan is about. You know, the 20 different initiatives in the 2020 plan that they could ramp up and get going right away, the very first one is the PR portion.
Well, but it wasn't because it was PR. That's a misconception. It's because it was one of the only recommendations of the 20 that was actually specific and required, you know, an action.
Yeah, that actually laid out a plan of action, you know, versus the others, which were very vague. And, McGinn also told reporters this week that the costs in implementing the 2020 plan would be covered by the current SPD budget, which is about $254 million. That recruiting and training and having these 34 officers take on additional job responsibilities was not going to lead to any overtime and was not going to lead to any new hires and was not going to cost the department anything. Revising the training for the entire staff of the Seattle Police Department, bringing in new training materials, et cetera, that's not going to cost anything. I don't believe that. He also said,
well, it's true if they don't actually intend to change anything.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It's true if it's only a PR initiative. McGinn then said he was setting aside about $5 million a year to pay for any initiatives the Department of Justice requires, including what he called a shadow chief appointed by the court to oversee reforms at the SPD, and any additional staff for the Office of Professional Accountability, which we hear is probably one of the initiatives that the DOJ is going to require. Now, the city must respond to the Department of Justice Justice's confidential plan that they issued on March 30th that no one's been able to see. There's only five copies of the plan, and they're locked in a safe somewhere. Supposedly only the negotiators from the Department of Justice and certain city employees know what is in those plans. Apparently, in that plan, apparently Chief Diaz and Mayor McGinn know. If the DOJ, however, thinks that the city isn't responding to the plan that the DOJ released and isn't negotiating in good faith, they could eventually file a lawsuit, and that may be coming as soon as June. So we'll see.
And that, would cost the city substantially more than $5 million.
Yeah, and I have to say that the 2020 initiative, particularly in the way it's being rolled out, is not an adequate response.
All right. Moving on, double-digit tuition increase.
Yeah, Washington State universities and colleges are rolling out double-digit increases for the school year 2012 to 2013. The WSU Board of Regents voted for a 16% increase for the second year in a row. UW is going to vote in June on also a 16% increase after they increased tuition 20% last year. Evergreen and Central are going to see 14% increases in the fall. Eastern is going to have an 11% increase. Western is going to have 16% again this year, and the State Board of Community and Technical Colleges are going to be voting soon on tuition increases. They're looking at a 13% increase for full-time students and 11% for part-time, which is exactly what they did last year. And this is a real shame. Now, the Board of Regents for these different universities and colleges, they say, well, you know, we're not in line with national tuition. Down in California, they charge another, you know, couple thousand a year for tuition compared to Washington State. But, you know, that's not the measure here. The measure here is, can students afford what you're offering? And if you have students who apply, are accepted, and then have to decline because they can't afford tuition, that's a problem. And that's been going on with much more frequency in the last couple of years.
All right. And finally, on local, the loss of a local news outlet.
Yeah, about 3 years ago, Josh Feit and Erica C. Barnett, formerly of the Strangers News staff, started a website called publiccola.com, which basically focused on local reporting and City Hall, City Council, and it's basically for political wonks. Very successful in terms of the actual reporting that they did, and you get the impression that they sort of lived and breathed it day and night.
And, you know, but they broke a lot of really good stories,
They did. They broke a lot of good stories. Well, they announced this week, unfortunately, that they couldn't make the business model work, which is not surprising because on top of the difficulty of monetizing content on the Internet, they started right into the teeth of a very bad economic downturn. So what they're going to do instead is to fold some of Publicola's current content into the David Brewster website, crosscut.com. Now, if anybody's ever looked at Crosscut, which is also, you know, civic for Seattle and for the Pacific Northwest, it's like if you go to one of those adult sites where you have to check a box saying you're at least 18 for Crosscut, you have to check a box saying you're at least 60 years of age. It's sort of a get off my lawn.com vibe to it. And it's going to be a very different audience, in other words, from what Publicola was dedicated to, and one much less specific about how city government works or how county government works, and one much more specific about we like things the way they used to be, where people in power did things without being questioned about them. So it's good that some of the content will continue. The venue, unfortunately, is not very good. It will lose a lot of its existing audience, and it's a loss anytime you have reporting like that that goes away, because frankly, other than the Stranger itself, nobody else in the town is really doing that kind of reporting anymore. The Seattle Times certainly doesn't. They pretty much stopped doing it after the PI went away.
The PI doesn't have the staff to do that.
The PI doesn't have the staff to do it. The neighborhood blogs, that's not really their beat. And so really important decisions are being made behind closed doors. You know, the whole response to the SPD debacle being only one of many, many examples. And, there's no real local reporting left that can hold officials' feet to the fire over it. It's very sad.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to national, and President Obama coming out supporting gay marriage.
Yay.
Oh yeah. It's nice to see that happen. However, when you think about how it happened, Obama was literally forced into it by his vice president, Joe Biden, who in an interview a few days before said that he supports gay marriage. And so, of course, the Obama administration had to scramble when reporters came and asked the president, started asking the president, do you support gay marriage? They had to sit down and figure out, okay, how is this going to affect us politically? But it was nice to see that they made the right decision, that Obama was able to come out and say that he supports gay marriage. Now, we kind of knew that personally, that's probably how he felt, since when one of the first things he did when he was elected to office was he told the Department of Justice to stop enforcing the Defense of Marriage Act. So,
and not only that, but to not defend the Defense of Marriage Act against the lawsuits that were against it. Mm-hmm. Frank, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I think in 20 years, people are not going to remember nor care about what the political calculations were behind it, or the circumstances of Joe Biden, or the election chances, or anything like that. What they're going to remember is that a president of the United States really for the first time ever affirmed basic civil rights for people who are attracted to other people of the same sex. And for anybody who is old enough, whether they're a queer or a queer ally or whomever, to have lived through the era in which Ronald Reagan went 8 entire years without even mentioning the AIDS pandemic at a time when literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people were dying, mm-hmm. and a lot of Americans believe that they had that coming to them. The import of this week, even if it's only at a symbolic level, is tremendously important. It's important to gay kids trying to figure out their sexuality, to their families, to gay elders who've seen a transition from a time in which they were persecuted in every imaginable way in this country to this day. The changes have happened really fast, and this really was a milestone. And I don't think people are going to remember, years from now when all of this stuff is normalized, they're not going to remember the circumstances behind the announcement, but they will remember the announcement.
Nevertheless, there's no legislation behind it.
No, that's absolutely true. It's completely symbolic.
Yeah, it's completely symbolic. And until Congress acts on repealing the Defense of Marriage Act or allowing or providing for marriage for gay people, then there isn't a whole lot of action that can be taken.
No, but it's certainly not. But Obama can't do that himself.
No, that's
I mean,
true.
He's actually done a lot of the things that he could do
he
in
could
terms of
push
ending
his party to propose legislation.
That's very true, but he couldn't get it through either the House or the Senate right now.
Yeah, you can't get much of anything.
And that's even if all Democrats were behind it, which more and more of them in the days since his announcement have signed on, it's like he opened the floodgates for them. But he's done a lot of what he could do. He ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He ended the federal government's legal defense of the Defense of Marriage Act. So he's done some good things. Now, did he take too long to get around to this position?
Oh,
absolutely.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you wish that this were something that that again there were a more aggressive legislative agenda around. But still, in terms of just the affirmation that this is a segment of our society that cannot be separated out and scorned because of who they are, it's a tremendous day.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, we had Mitt Romney, who was challenged by reporters who revealed that when he was in high school, he led a gang of boys in harassing a gay student.
And there were actually a number of other incidents. It wasn't just that one, although that was the worst one.
Well, I haven't heard about the other incidences.
Oh, I'll tell you about them.
Okay.
But go ahead.
No, Romney was accused by reporters and by other classmates of his when he was in high school of leading a gang of boys and taking down, literally physically assaulting a gay student and cutting off his hair. And Romney said, well, we got into a lot of pranks when I was in high school, and he didn't really remember actually having done it, while there were other boys who were part of that whole scenario who remembered it very well. And it haunts them. It's pretty hard to believe.
Including the victim, by the way.
Yeah, the victim is no longer alive.
No, but
he did make a statement to a friend saying that years after the event that he still thought about it quite a bit.
Yeah.
From time to time. And Romney, of course, said, well, I don't remember having done it. And it makes you wonder, you know, if you lead a gang of boys, you pin somebody down, the guy is terrified, he's even crying, and you're cutting his hair off, and you're literally bullying him. You know, what kind of person is it who doesn't remember doing something like that?
Well, there's two possible answers to that. The first answer is that Romney is lying. The second answer is that he did it so many times that they all bore together. And, you know, the evidence both in the original Washington Post story, this came out in the Post on Thursday, and I would encourage people to go seek out that story and read it, because it's not just about the John Lauder, I believe was the name of the victim. It wasn't just about John Lauder. It was also about a blind teacher that they did all kinds of cruel things to, and you know, a number of other people, always people who had, you know, were in some way powerless. Vis-a-vis Romney, who at that point was not only a high school student, he was also a son of the sitting governor. And in a private, elite private school that prided itself on throwing people out of school for the least kind of infraction of the rules, he wasn't touched. He, this stuff was all out there and known, and he was never disciplined for any of it.
Knew how to work the system to get what he wanted. And that's
he knew he was protected because his father was the governor.
Yes.
And his father was not only the governor, but somebody who gave a lot of prestige to Cranbrook, which is the name of the school. And, you know, you see, it wouldn't resonate nearly as much. And even his response that 50 years on, he didn't remember that specific incident, wouldn't resonate nearly as much if it weren't part of an ongoing pattern, a pattern in which he can strap a dog to the roof of a car, a pattern in which he doesn't care about the poor, a pattern in which he makes a fortune by eliminating the jobs of thousands of people that he never met, never saw, never cared about. You know, you get the impression that this is a person who has a pathological inability to empathize. And that part has not changed since he was 18 years old. It's still true. And giving somebody like that the kind of power that comes with the presidency of the United States is a very, very frightening prospect.
All right. Let's move on. J.P. Morgan in the news this week.
Actually, let's talk about the Department of Justice lawsuit filed against the Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona. Arpaio has been in the news quite a bit because he's considered the law and order sheriff who's going to deal with them immigrants. He directed his Maricopa County department to what he termed enforce national immigration laws because he thought that the federal government wasn't doing that. Well, it turns out the Department of Justice, after having investigated him for a couple of years now, at least, they brought a lawsuit against him for racial discrimination, partly for racial discrimination in traffic stops. In other words, pulling over people and arresting them for driving while Latino, doing sweeps of homes and workplaces to hunt down Latinos and immigrants, whether they were legal or not legal, and arresting them. And also tried to silence his critics, which included several lawyers and judges, by filing intimidating lawsuits that were later found to be baseless. In other words, he kind of ran over everybody.
And why this man is not in jail utterly escapes me.
And Arpaio says that the DOJ lawsuit is the Obama administration targeting him during an election year. However, I want to point out that the Department of Justice started investigating him during the Bush administration. He's been doing this long enough. And in December, the Department of Justice issued a report on the investigation and then sought to negotiate with Arpaio to make changes in his department. He, however, refused to have an independent monitor in his office and refused to negotiate, and now the DOJ has filed a lawsuit. And this is very similar to what's been happening here in Seattle. After a DOJ investigation, we've also had a Department of Justice report saying we need an outside monitor. If the city refuses to negotiate, it doesn't want an outside monitor, well, we could be looking at a lawsuit too.
There's one important difference, though, which is that one of the other things that Arpaio did in response to that last December was launch an investigation, which he trumpeted with a press conference, et cetera, claiming that he had new evidence that Obama was born in Kenya. So this is the kind of guy we're dealing with.
All right. J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, this week J.P. Morgan shocked the markets worldwide by saying that they had a $2 billion loss on one type of proprietary trading that they had done in derivatives. Now, proprietary trading, just to remind you, is trading that a bank does for its own benefit. In other words, in an attempt to make its own profit. It isn't doing it on behalf of any clients. Now, they said that the trading that they were doing was to try to hedge the loans that they make. Now, the size of the loss really proves otherwise, because any profits that they got from investments that they were supposedly hedging that moved in opposition to this derivatives position that they took were much, much, much smaller than this $2 billion loss. Now, since 2008, when the crash happened, J.P. Morgan has always been considered the most stable of the big banks. They actually did the best coming out of 2008 of any of the other big banks. And so this really proves that there are still big systemic risks here.
And they're all doing them. It's not just J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, they're all doing them. And the fact that the one that was considered the most conservative and the most sound of the big banks can just suddenly announce, well, we're not going to have a profit this quarter. We've got a $2 billion loss. Furthermore, this $2 billion loss isn't a one-time thing. It could be a bigger loss, and it could run into at least the second quarter. And why is that? It's because they can't just sell the derivatives that they purchased, because to do that, they purchased so many of them, because to do that, they would literally it would literally have a huge impact on the market. In other words, they were buying so many of these things that it was distorting the market. This shows you that big banks really need to be reined in terms of what they do with their money. And that the Volcker rule, the rule that's supposed to limit what big banks can do in terms of proprietary trading, needs to be made stronger, and it needs to be simplified.
All right. And briefly on national, a couple of actions related to the Senate.
Yeah, the GOP blocked the Senate with another one of their filibusters, blocked the Senate from taking action to prevent a doubling of student loan interest rates this week. Harry Reid actually came out in the aftermath of this and acknowledged that some junior Democratic senators who had wanted at the beginning of the session to reform the filibuster rules to prevent the Republicans from, you know, using 41 members to block any and all legislation or consideration of appointments and whatnot. The Democratic leadership had been opposed to this coming in, and he acknowledged that they were wrong, that the Republicans had been abusing this and that reform needed to take place. Hopefully, if the Democrats, which doesn't seem likely, retain control of the Senate after the elections in this fall, they have to defend a much larger number of seats this year than the Republicans do. So just the math tells you that it's likely the Republicans will have control of the Senate. But if Reid is still the majority speaker in 2013, hopefully people will remember this and demand filibuster reform so something can get done. The other interesting thing from the Senate this week, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee announced that on July 17th, coming up in a couple months, it will be holding hearings on overturning Citizens United, the 2010 Supreme Court decision that allows unlimited money and unlimited corporate money in elections. In this session alone, 24 senators, all of them Democrats, of course, have sponsored or co-sponsored 13 different proposed constitutional amendments aimed at overturning Citizens United. So this is a way of both publicizing and trying to consolidate support for those amendments.
All right. And elections in Europe.
Yeah, this week there were some pretty astounding results of elections in Europe. In France, socialist candidate François Hollande was elected. He beat out Nicolas Sarkozy, the conservative incumbent. In Germany, local elections showed trouble for Angela Merkel's center-right coalition when voters deserted her parties and went for other ones. In Britain, local elections also showed big gains for the Labour Party, which has been very anti-austerity in Britain, and big losses for David Cameron's Conservatives. In fact, Labour won 800 seats, which is their best showing since 1997, whereas the Conservatives lost 400 seats, which had the backbenchers calling for blood. trying to figure out how David Cameron was going to recover from this. And then in Greece, the biggest news, in Greece, the two main governing parties that had negotiated the bailout and austerity measures with the European Union, they lost much of their support to third parties, especially to Syriza, which is the radical left party. Now, the radical left party campaigned on a platform that was against austerity measures, and they wanted to impose a freeze on Greece's debt repayments for 3 years. And, of course, voters liked what they heard there, and they supported Syriza in record numbers. Now, no party in Greece took a majority, and no two parties together can form one. And so all of this week, the baton has been passed from one party chief to another to try to form a government. Now, all of the parties so far have failed to form a government. And if no one can form a government, then Greece will have to go through another round of elections. And if they do, Syriza, the radical left party, looks like they could make some very big gains in that election. So what's ahead for Greece? Greece may actually, Syriza's plan would be for Greece eventually to exit the European Union, to have its own currency back, which then they can use to help them get out of the recession that they've been in for the last 5 or 6 years.
All right, Afghanistan.
Yeah, a couple things. Last Friday, a week ago yesterday, two NATO airstrikes killing 20 people in Afghanistan, at least, including a mother and her 5 kids. Happy Mother's Day. And a Christian Science Monitor poll out this week about the Afghan Security Pact through 2024 that we talked about a couple weeks ago. 63% of Americans oppose that pact. Only 33% are in favor of them. And the interesting part about that, a couple of things. Number one, the numbers were virtually identical for both Democrats and Republicans, strongly opposing the ongoing commitment in Afghanistan. And that there are virtually no undecideds, meaning that that number is not likely to change in the future. The way the Obama administration handled it won't even have to go through the Senate and get approved there. There's no public process at all, and we're now committed.
All right. Events.
Several of them. Today, a couple things going on that have already started. The Seattle Race Conference, registration going on right now. The conference itself from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. That'll be at Seattle University's Pigeot.
I think it's Pigot, yeah.
Hall. If you have a chance, hurry on down there. They have a bunch of great speakers. The morning keynote, Yolanda Sinde, the Community Coalition for Environmental Justice co-founder. Also today, all day, Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action's annual Mother's Day action. That is across from the Bangor Nuclear Subbase in Kitsap County at 16159 Clear Creek Road Northwest. For a schedule of events, you can check gzcenter.org. Tomorrow from 12 to 5 o'clock, there will be a public installation of Palestine's Stolen Homeland that will be down at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine. On Thursday, the May 17th, 7 p.m., there will be a screening of Princess Angeline. She, as local history buffs may know, is the daughter of Chief Seattle. That'll be a film benefit to benefit Duwamish youth. $5 suggested donation at the UW School of Social Work, room 305 at 41st and 15th Northeast. Also on Thursday through June 10th, the launch of the Seattle International Film Festival. And as usual this year, there's a bunch of great films. You can look at the whole schedule at www.siff.net.
Also, Tuesday, there's the hearing on Hanford happening at the University Heights Center, which is Northeast 50th and University Way Northeast, starting at 7 p.m., and there'll be a pre-hearing at 6:15 p.m. put on by Heart of America Northwest. Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
Yes, and you can find more of my work at mariatomczyk.com.